to honor Robert P. George, and I'm very pleased to be able to discuss Jim Stoner's excellent paper. And to discuss John Rawls, Robert George really formed my understanding of John Rawls. And so everything I say today that's intelligent, he should get the credit for. Everything else I'm going to say, I'll take full responsibility for myself. As discussant, I want to raise and discuss some issues for your consideration and Jim's consideration. And in doing so, I want to in particular touch on some of the deep currents of the liberal political sensibility that's on display in the work of John Rawls. And I want to ultimately suggest that John Rawls could not have recognized the communitarian and potentially pro-paternalist implications of the Aristotelian principle and its companion effect, at least not without fundamentally changing his political outlook and who he was as a philosopher. So I want to approach Rawls and these questions from a slightly different angle than Jim. I'm not a professional political philosopher. I'm a law professor. I teach doctrinal constitutional law, and I write about theories of judging and legal and interpretation. I'm particularly interested in broadly Rawlsian trends in American constitutional law and what we might call the sociological Rawls. And by the sociological Rawls, I mean Rawls as a representative of contemporary liberalism, that associated with the left wing of the Democratic Party since the 1960s. Rawls is a highly sophisticated philosopher, and he needs to be appreciated as such, and Jim has certainly done that today. But in a very important sense, Rawls is just another Northeastern liberal, right? If you want to understand Rawls, that's what you start out with. He's another Northeastern liberal. And if you keep that in mind, you won't go wrong. And those are not in short supply, alas, right? There's lots of them and more every year. As a philosophic defender of this liberal sensibility, Rawls' justifications for liberalism can shed light on liberalism as a social phenomenon. And the reverse is true as well. Liberalism as a social phenomenon can help us understand what Rawls is all about. So by way of raising issues for discussion, I want to say something about Rawls and the self-image of liberalism, Rawls and the basic political norm of liberalism and the social realm, liberal autonomy, and Rawls and the suggestion that social conservatives keep our conservatism in our private lives and out of public life. And then I want to close with some examples of Rawlsian trends in American constitutional law, which are quite disturbing. Rawls' famous philosophical concepts of the original position, the veil of ignorance, public reason, and others reflect liberalism's fundamental self-image. Many liberals appear to believe that liberalism on social issues is what you get when people respect the autonomy of others and put aside prejudice, bigotry, and divisive sectarian religious and political beliefs. How many times have we heard liberals use the word tolerance as a code word for social liberalism with its ungenerous and unfair implication that social conservatives are intolerant? And many liberals appear to believe that economic liberalism is what you get when people set aside their narrow economic self-interest and their greed. How many times have we heard liberals use the word compassion as a code word for economic liberalism with its ungenerous and unfair implication that conservatives are selfish and unfeeling? The self-conceit that liberals are just reasonable people who set aside prejudice in favor of tolerance and selfishness in favor of compassion is fundamental to liberalism's appeal to many persons. It's also fundamental to liberalism's attitude towards conservatives and conservatism. And it's present to a significant degree in Rawls. It's built into his theory of justice, though it's expressed with a quiet civility and a sophistication that other liberals would do well to emulate. Second, Rawls' basic concepts also reflect the fundamental political norm of liberalism in the realm of social issues. That norm is respect for a radical conception of individual autonomy or freedom of choice. For liberals today, individual autonomy is the highest political value when it comes to the issues associated with the culture wars. And conservative justifications for limits on autonomy are viewed with suspicion and hostility. At best, they're thought of as unjust attempts to legislate morality. At worst, they're an improper recourse to sectarian religious faith or to simple bigotry. Autonomy or freedom of choice is also viewed as a politically neutral value, not a controversial liberal value that is deployed against rival conservative values. And restrictions on autonomy are viewed as a non-neutral exercise. They impose one rival conception of the good over others, rather than respecting the autonomy of all persons in a neutral fashion. Of course, it's far from clear why we should value autonomy in such absolute terms, as does Rawls, when there are other goods and values at stake, and when it's clear that we can all make bad choices that hurt ourselves and others, our families, our friends, and our communities. Moreover, radical autonomy is not a politically neutral value. Liberalism is best understood as conceiving of autonomy as itself a good, in fact, the fundamental or overarching good in the social realm. And radical autonomy is a liberal individualist norm, opposed to rival conservative and communitarian norms, and it simply privileges autonomy as a good or value over other goods or values favored by conservatives and communitarians. And if we turn to Rawls and the justifications for that political norm of radical autonomy, we find both a moral justification and I think what we can conceive of as a kind of prudential justification. The moral justification is an appeal to justice. As we've already heard, the view here is that one displays a fundamentally unjust lack of respect for others when one attempts to restrict their autonomy in ways they can reasonably reject. But this justification is simply unpersuasive. It shows no lack of respect to others to advocate policies that will help to make men moral, to pick a phrase at random, right? Or to improve the moral environment in which we all must live. It's not unjust to debate the goods of individuals and communities in terms of their actual goods, and it's not unjust to debate those actual goods of individuals and communities simply because there's going to be disagreement over them. That's what debate is for. To pick just one example, it's not unjust to advocate restrictions on highly addictive and destructive substances like methamphetamine or crack cocaine simply because there are some persons who view these as a good to be pursued because of their pharmacological effects, despite whatever consequences may flow from them. In fact, if there's a real injustice in this area, it's the invocation of the concept of pluralism to justify suppressing debate. One can also find a kind of prudential justification, at least implicit in Rawls' thought. It's a concern for social stability, the stability that liberal autonomy is thought to provide. Clearly, legislation that reflects a contested conception of the good is going to be socially divisive. If it's contested, it's going to be divisive. But a social stability justification for liberal autonomy is also unpersuasive for some reasons I think Jim covered very well. It's true that Americans are divided over social issues, but we're also divided over foreign policy and over large-scale economic issues. There's no evidence of undue civil unrest on social issues now, in the recent past, or on the horizon. Moreover, historically, it's liberals who were aggressors in the culture war. They are the ones who challenge the socially conservative status quo, and therefore they're most clearly responsible for whatever political instability we may happen to experience. A liberal surrender to traditional conservatism would be just as likely to promote stability as a conservative surrender to contemporary liberalism. But what about Rawls and social conservatives? Rawls knows that we're not just going to disappear. He recognizes that in a pluralistic society there will be conservatives, but he has a proposal for us, which I suspect few social conservatives will find compelling. And this proposal involves one of Rawls' basic distinctions between the metaphysical realm and the political realm. The metaphysical realm concerns private spheres, such as family, church, and voluntary associations and civil society. The political realm concerns the public realm of public policy and politics in our constitutional democracy. There are liberals in the metaphysical realm, individuals who are liberals in their private sphere, in their personal life, family life, church life, voluntary associations. There are conservatives in the metaphysical realm, persons who are conservative in their private life, family life, and church life. The metaphysical liberal will be a political liberal as the metaphysical liberal moves from the private realm of, say, family and church to the public realm of public policy and politics. That's to be expected. But according to Rawls, a metaphysical conservative can and should be a political liberal, as the metaphysical conservative moves from the private realm of family and church into the public sphere of public policy and politics. Just check your hat, your coat, and your conservatism at the courthouse door, Rawls seems to say. And the moral justification for this is one we've already encountered. Metaphysical conservatives should respect a liberal conception of individual autonomy and recognize that their conservative beliefs are grounded in sectarian religious faith or controversial conceptions of the good, neither of which are legitimate reasons for action in the public sphere. Thus, a metaphysical liberal is likely both metaphysically and politically pro-abortion and pro-same-sex marriage, and a metaphysical conservative is metaphysically pro-life and pro-traditional marriage in his private life of family and church, but likely should be politically pro-abortion and pro-same-sex marriage in the public sphere, though Rawls himself, it should be noted, is famously equivocated over his theory in the question of abortion. Still, we see this liberal dynamic all the time in the area of abortion with politicians who claim religious affiliations that are pro-life. I'm personally opposed to abortion, they say, but politically pro-choice, explaining that political opposition to abortion would be somehow the improper imposition of their private religious views on others. Jimmy Carter, Mario Cuomo, John Kerry has done this. Are there any good reasons for social conservatives to take Rawls up on this proposal? As suggested, the liberal autonomy norm is not neutral between competing conceptions of the good. It's just a liberal conception of the good, which elevates autonomy as a good over other goods. And also, as suggested, as a general matter, it's not unjust or imprudent to debate the public good in terms of actual goods, not unjust or imprudent to appeal to a conception of the good simply because it happens to be contestable or contested by others in one society. Just as liberal autonomy as a norm is both contestable and contested by conservatives and communitarians. The move from a recognition of pluralism to an argument for liberal hegemony in public life is really an astonishing turn in Rawls's thought. Therefore, there's no impediment, for instance, to acting politically on the belief that unborn children are individual members of the human species, that they're persons and entitled to the full protection of the criminal laws to protect their lives, life being a basic human good. But if Rawlsian liberalism strikes the average conservative as deeply implausible, it still represents a very influential strain of thought. And I want to conclude with a few examples from the case law of the Supreme Court, that exemplar of public reason, as Rawls calls it, and as Jim nicely quoted, that doesn't send a chill up my back so much as just make me laugh, right? The exemplar of public reason. Take Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision first declaring a constitutional right to abortion in 1973. In Justice Blackmun's opinion of the court, the idea that the Constitution contained some sweeping zone of individual autonomy which could encompass abortion, then prohibited in 46 states in significant degree, was treated as obvious, even though it had little or no support in law and was highly controversial politically. And the idea that the interest of the state in protecting unborn children from the violent death they might experience at the hands of an abortionist, that the idea that that interest could justify anti-abortion legislation was rejected by the court because there was no philosophical consensus in favor of the value of fetal life. Notice how an assertion of individual autonomy is treated as, in effect, politically neutral and unproblematic, no matter how controversial it may be, but the controversiality of the reason for restricting the exercise of autonomy is viewed as fatal to it as a justification. In a similar vein, when the court affirmed the right to abortion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, the plurality stated, this is a quote, "Some of us as individuals find abortion offensive to our most basic principles of morality, but that cannot control our decision. Our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code." Notice that judicial policymaking in favor of abortion is simply defining the liberty of all. But judicial recognition of a state interest in protecting the life of unborn children, which would have allowed, but not required, states to restrict abortion, would be mandating the justice's personal moral code. Again, radical autonomy, a substantively liberal moral value, is viewed as the neutral default position of the Constitution, despite the fact that that has no support in legal materials. And restrictions on that autonomy reflecting moral concerns rejected by most liberals, such as the value of fetal life, are considered invalid. Recognizing them is to mandate a moral code in some fashion. This is the judicial version of, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but politically I can't impose that view on others. Now it's, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but constitutionally I can't allow Democratic majorities to do that, even though there's nothing in the Constitution that would seem to actually prohibit that action. Finally, consider the Supreme Court's opinion in Lawrence versus Texas in 2003. In that case, the Supreme Court invalidated the anti-sodomy laws of several states. Justice Kennedy's majority opinion asserted that the Constitution again contains a sweeping zone of individual autonomy, without support in legal materials, which encompasses a right of sexual privacy or sexual intimacy, and he further asserted that there's not even a legitimate state interest in restricting or prohibiting sodomy. Justice O'Connor's concurrence in the judgment in that opinion in that case is notable because it amplifies this last point. O'Connor equated moral disapproval of homosexual conduct with moral disapproval of homosexuals as a group or class. Disapproval of the conduct is disapproval of the group or class associated with the conduct. And she equated moral disapproval of homosexuals as a group or class with animus, malice, or spite, a bare desire to harm homosexuals. And all this was done without any attempt to engage the moral basis of the traditional disapproval of homosexual conduct or explain why it's mistaken or suspect or even simply irrelevant. In short, moral disapproval of homosexual conduct is constitutionally indistinguishable from bigotry. Both are impermissible bases for legislation, and that can be stated without a supporting argument in a completely conclusory fashion. Kennedy and O'Connor read together fit the pattern. Autonomy is a politically neutral default position of the Constitution. Whether a particular exercise of autonomy is politically controversial or not appears to be irrelevant to its constitutional standing, as does its actual support in legal materials. and any moral basis for restriction on that autonomy, which liberals reject as controversially moralistic, can be dismissed without argument as the constitutional equivalent of bigotry, if not bigotry itself. So I believe the Rawlsian project is a failure as a matter of political philosophy, but it can help us understand much about contemporary liberalism, such as the way liberals justify to themselves the imposition of liberal policies by judicial fiat on voters. The imposition of such liberal values on voters by unelected judges is viewed as a politically neutral activity, simply protecting the liberal autonomy rights of all. And the judicial failure to impose liberal values on voters is viewed as the mandating of a personal moral code by judges, achieved through the proxy of state legislatures willing to enact such codes into law. Judicial imposition of liberalism is politically neutral, then, and the mere judicial allowance of legislative conservatism is viewed as politically partisan and improper. Quite a twist, you might think, but also quite evident in the court's jurisprudence, in Rawlsian thought, and in the liberal sensibility that underlies them both. Now, as Jim has shown, Rawls's underdevelopment and ultimate abandonment of the Aristotelian principle is certainly part of the problem. But I want to close with this question. Wasn't this failure to recognize the communitarian implications of the Aristotelian principle inevitable, in some sense, given the fundamentally individualist nature of Rawls's political sensibility? Or to put it another way, if Rawls could have seen the implications and followed them to their logical conclusions, he would not be the philosophical mandarin of modern liberalism that we know today, but a very different philosopher, an ally perhaps, rather than an adversary. Thank you.